Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Gospel according to St. John, the 10th chapter, the 11th through the 18th verse. It is the Johannine passage about the Good Shepherd. And it begins, Jesus said, I am the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherd is one who lays down his life for his sheep. The hired man, since he is not the shepherd, and the sheep do not belong to him, abandons the sheep and runs away as soon as he sees a wolf coming. And then the wolf attacks and scatters the sheep. This is because he is only a hired man and has no concern for the sheep. This section right here of this particular gospel presumes our familiarity with the story that comes before it. And that story is the story of the man born blind. When Jesus anoints his eyes with spittle and clay, and the man's eyes are opened and he is able to see for the first time in his life. The fact is, however, that Jesus does this on the Sabbath day, which incurs, of course, the wrath of the Pharisees. And so when Jesus now begins to talk about the true shepherd and the hired hand, he's talking, obviously, and making reference, obviously, to the absurdity of the Pharisees in this situation. Here, a man blind from birth has his sight restored by Jesus Christ. And in so doing, of course, instead of being awed and grateful to God that someone should have this kind of power to overcome the consequences of sinfulness in the world. And we know, once again, biblically, all evil is the result of human sinfulness. Not necessarily I sinned and so this is my punishment, but humanity sins and brings down upon itself a distorted, a disorderly kind of world in which to live, in which, you know, we see the healing and the restoration of that world looked at pretty clearly in the prophecies of Isaiah on the holy mountain, for instance, the banquet of the Lord, and the lamb will lay down with the lion, and the child shall put his hand in an adder's lair, and so forth. That there is total harmony and peace in the created order as it came forth from the hand of God. It is the sinfulness of humanity. And humanity's sinfulness is interesting, because the root, the fundamental sin of humanity, the original sin, has to do with the decision made by Eve and her husband Adam. And it lays at the basis of almost every sin. And some say, well, it was the sin of pride. Well, yeah, it is the sin of pride in some way. But basically, it is the resistance to being under the benevolent rule of the Creator God versus doing it myself. Now, that is pride, obviously, but it's a very specific kind of pride. And it's the kind of pride that underlies every, I know I shouldn't do this, or God says I shouldn't do this, but I can do what I want. I'm a free person. And, of course, they're absolutely correct. They are free to do evil if they so choose to do so. And certainly Adam and Eve chose to do so to the dire consequences for humanity. But here we find that because it is on the Sabbath, and because the Pharisees are the guardians of the institutional Jewish religion as it exists underneath the Roman government, the Roman governorship, the Roman occupancy, that they then become, it becomes, their position within that society becomes dependent upon their being the arbiters of all things. And in so doing, of course, they are looking after not the well-being of the people. If they were looking after the well-being of the people, they would have rejoiced that a man born blind had received his sight. But they were not. They saw it as a challenge to their authority and a challenge to their interpretation of the law. And no one had the right to question them or challenge them. And because they had so arranged themselves in alliance with Rome that that they held absolute authority in the society religiously, by not by appointment by the divine being, but by appointment by the Roman Empire. So they really, under the guise of religion, are secular apparatchiks of a sort. They are the ones charged with keeping peace and within the Jewish community and preventing the kinds of rebelliousness and the kinds of resistance to Roman rule that had been kind of endemic to the whole story of the Roman occupation, and which is to reach its nadir in 70 AD when Rome decides to destroy the temple and destroy Jerusalem. So that what the Pharisees are trying to do is to protect the worldly kingdom from the heavenly kingdom. And how often do we see that, I wonder? So here we have then, Jesus is contrasting himself with the Pharisees. This gospel needs the previous story in order for its context to be more clearly understood, because he obviously now refers back to the Pharisees as the hirelings, as the ones who are in place by the power of Rome and not by the right of the covenant with God. And he says, what happens when this happens? And he said, this is what happened, that their hired men, since he is not with the sheep and the sheep do not belong to him, he abandons the sheep and he runs away. And so the people really could not count on the Sadducees and the Pharisees to look after them in hard times. They were more than willing to sell them out to the Romans. And, of course, we see they're working at this along with the high priest during the Passion of the Lord and the trial of Jesus, when Pilate tries to appease the crowd by saying, you know, I will release Jesus to you and send Barabbas. And we've seen before, Barabbas is Bar Abba, which means the son of the father, which means a false messiah and an insurrectionist false messiah, one who sees a political solution and has no qualms at what the damage done by that political solution in order to attain whatever his personal goals might be. And it is a warning to all of those who feel that the solution to the crisis within Catholicism today is a political solution. It is not. It is a solution of fidelity, a solution of prayer, and a solution of trust in the goodness of God, and not in the machinations of the darkness of the political world. We see this on an international level. We see it on a national level. We see it locally. In many, many different ways. There are those who would prefer to appease the secular order than to be obedient to the Lord. And so that's what Jesus is talking about. However, he uses a very familiar term in order to do that. And the very familiar term that he uses is, of course, the shepherd and the sheep. And all of the appurtenances thereof. And so he talks about the sheep knowing him and all of this. And so he goes on to say, as soon as he sees a wolf coming and the wolf attacks and scatters the sheep, this is because he's only a hired man and has no concern for the sheep. Again, he's referring to the Pharisees in the story of the man born blind. But he says, I am the good shepherd, and I know mine, and mine know me. And this is a common allusion. This is something that everybody kind of understands. Even the urban dwellers of Jerusalem understand this, that at night, for their protection from wild animals and thieves and so forth, the sheep are put into corrals. And there is someone who guards the gate of the corral. And when it's time to go back out into the pasture, the shepherd who is in charge of those sheep comes in. They recognize his voice, and then those are the sheep that follow him out of the sheep gate into under his care and under his security and with total trust and confidence that this is the way that their life is best lived. And so he says now, he says, the same way I know my Father and the Father knows me. In other words, this kind of trust and confidence and reliance and all of those kinds of things are part of the relationship of the Father and the Son. And it's in John's Gospel especially that this unique relationship between Father and Son and Spirit surfaces. And so it's in John's Gospel where we find the greatest affirmation of the Trinitarian God. And so he says, "And I know my Father, and my Father knows me, and I lay down my life for my sheep." In other words, this is an allusion to what is going to come to be in Jesus' life. He is going to lay down his life. He has the choice. The Pharisees and the Sadducees run and hide when the danger comes. Jesus faces it and accepts it and the personal consequences of it in order that he might redeem his sheep, in order that he might open for them the gates of heaven, we say. And so, and then he says, "And there are other sheep I have that are not of this fold, and these I have to lead as well. They too will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd." So now this gospel is recognizing and acknowledging. This is not, you know, saying, well, gee, you know, Christianity, the disciples of Christ are going to split into hundreds of segments, and they all belong to the one shepherd. It's not what it's talking about. It's not affirming it. It's not denying it. It's just not talking about it. What it's talking about is the relationship between the Jews and the Gentiles, and that what Jesus has done and has indicated he is going to do, but he then leave to his disciples to do. But he does not himself do it except in a rare occasion, such as, for instance, with the Syrophoenician woman and so forth. But basically, it is the gospel's acknowledgement of the inclusion of the Gentiles in the messianic mission of Jesus and in the redemptive sacrifice of Jesus. And Jesus says, so we might even put that word in here, so the Gentiles too will listen to my voice, and there will be only one flock and one shepherd. So that the truth of Jesus Christ and the true faith that Jesus Christ brings is going to be extended out into the Gentile world as well. And then he says something significant too. All of it's significant, but this is particularly interesting. The Father loves me because I lay down my life in order to take it up again. Here's the story of the passion, the death, and the resurrection of the Lord, and saying that throughout all that, the Father loves him, and loves him because of the infinite generosity of his heart, which is willing to be poured out completely for the sake of those whom God has created and who he desires to have as his own. And Jesus is making it very clear that what's going to happen to him is not that he is not the victim of the machinations of the world, which of course he is, but that he himself has to cooperate in their evil intent for a good purpose, and he is willing to do that. For we hear oftentimes about, you know, well, in fact, as St. Anselm was one of them that went deeply into this, that somehow or other this was, the death of Jesus was a juridical phenomenon, that since man had sinned against God but was incapable of repairing an injury to the infinite, that only God then could repay the debt. And there's some value in that. And actually, there's an interesting book called The Law and Revolution by Harold Berman, in which he develops this Anselmian understanding of the juridical satisfaction of the death of Jesus as one of the foundations of modern Western law. And it becomes a very important cultural part, therefore, the development of the Western civilization. But basically, it's more than that. It may be that, who knows, but it's more than that. And what it's more than that is that Jesus is willing to love completely. He is willing to love totally. And in that willingness to love totally, he gives all of himself out on the cross, out of love for humanity, and it is that love, then, which is sufficient to redeem us and save us from our sins. And he wants us to know that he does that willingly on his own. He is not forced into it by the Sanhedrin or by the high priests or by the Roman Empire. Listen again, the Father loves me because I lay down my life in order to take it up again. Because I lay down my life in order to take it up from me. No one takes it from me. I have laid it down of my own free will. And as it is in my power to lay it down, so it is in my power to take it up again. And think of that. That's not, you know, that's not the enforcement of a juridical sentence at all. What that really is that it is the ultimate quintessential act of generosity, the ultimate quintessential act of love that Jesus in some way performs and gives for the sake of our redemption and our salvation. We are not redeemed by a juridical process. We are redeemed by God's love for us as it is manifested in the total self-giving of Jesus on the cross. And so he says, and this is the command I have been given by my Father. And so the Father then has sent Jesus into the world knowing that his great love is going to be that which brings people back to the Lord, back to the kingdom of heaven, into redemption, into the possibility of salvation of their souls. So this then is kind of the story of the Good Shepherd. And as it is kind of the story of the Good Shepherd, it makes a lot of things very clear. First of all, that the Pharisees in the story of the man born blind are usurpers of the role of the law of Moses, usurpers of the chair of Moses. They are there because of politics and not because of the covenant. The second thing that he does is he shows the consequences of that and how they're going to behave and how they're going to act. And then he goes on to explain in this image, this parable of the Good Shepherd, that the Father knows me and I know the Father just like the sheep know me and I know them and so forth. There is this image given to us from the story of the sheep gate in which the sheep recognize the authentic voice of the shepherd and follow him wherever he goes. He then tells us that he will lay down his life for his sheep. In other words, the difference between him and the usurpers as the leaders of the people are that he will pour out his life for them. And the Pharisees and Sadducees and high priests, chief priests and so forth will not. In fact, is they're looking out for themselves. And they're looking out to become more acceptable members of a political society that is advantageous to them financially, socially, politically, and so forth. And then he says, then he goes on to say, and I want you to know that this love that I'm pouring out is not just for the Jews, but it is also for the Gentiles. And they too will listen to my voice. And we can certainly see, even in our present time of crisis, that Catholicism has spread throughout the world. And that throughout the world there are people, therefore, who hear the voice of the Lord and who respond to the voice of the Lord. And so they too will listen to my voice, and there will be only one flock and one shepherd. And then he goes on to talk about what this means. And what it means is the Father loves me because I lay down my life in order to take it up again. And then he goes into the whole juridical issue once again, that if it is a juridical judgment, then it is a judgment from outside. In this case, it is not a judgment from outside. It is a matter of the heart. And the heart says, because of my great love for these people, I will give them everything that I am and everything that I have. And I will do this because this is what the Father asks of me. And I know the Father, and the Father knows me. And I love the Father, and the Father loves me. And the Father and I are one. So, here we have then one of the very powerful images from the New Testament. The idea of the Good Shepherd is, you know, we always see the image of that story where Jesus comes back with the lost sheep carrying the lamb on his shoulders and so forth. The idea is we strive to get not only an intellectual and a verbal, but also a visual sense of what all this means. And actually, we usually basically will only in prayer be able to discover the depth of that meaning in the sense of the redemption of the world and our own redemption as well. And redemption, as we have seen before, is the creation of the possibility for us to be saved. The world is redeemed, but if we look around, we might say, well, the world is not saved, because redemption is the gift to humanity. And in giving the redemption to humanity, it is offered to the whole created order as well, since the whole created order's well-being depends upon the behavior of humanity. And that's biblical, and we've seen that before. But then also, it is, in a way, showing that it is not the law, even the modern law, which in any way, shape, or form defines the relationship between Christ and his people. It is purely and absolutely God's love that defines what Jesus is for us and who we can become for him. Now, if we take all this, we walk, of course, onto thin ice when we begin to say that, you know, well, what does this mean for us? Because there's some pretty obvious things. But one of them that we dare not ignore, and we've said this so many times before, there is no story of Jesus, there is no incident in the gospel which is trapped in the time of the first century. That is not kind of an image locked in time that has no life beyond its own time and place. That the New Testament, not only does it reveal Christ to the world, but it reveals us to ourselves as well. And it reveals to us what the world truly is. For here we see, if we go back to the prelude to this particular story of the Good Shepherd, and we find that the issue is the healing of the man born blind, and the resistance to that, and the attempt in some way, shape, or form to discredit that, and or to attribute it in some way to the devil, to Beelzebub, the Lord of the Flies, is because there is no love for the man in the eyes of the Pharisees. They do not care about him or about his parents. They are irrelevant. They are simply an irritant in the political structure of Jerusalem in the first century. When we realize that this kind of then is an overlay of the whole story of humanity, we can therefore peel any gospel, almost any gospel, out of the pages of the New Testament and overlay it on the reality of the modern day. And we see new characters, new figures emerge from these stories, and all of them are familiar to us, and all of them are recognizable by us. And we see the people who have lost faith in the covenant, and therefore have cast their lot with the political order as being the instruments of their redemption, the instruments of human salvation. We see this all over the place. We see it in the church and outside the church. We see as we abandon Christianity more and more and enter into a post-Christian age, we see also a radical abandonment of the order of the gospel, where love ceases to be the underlying current of redemption of humanity, and people turn more and more again to the juridical process, to the law, to politics. And so we have many professing Christians who are more faithful to the political world than they are to the world of Jesus Christ and to the world of redemption. And we can go into why is this? Why does this happen? And it's pretty interesting. Obviously, I can't say, well, this is the answer. But certainly there is many things to take place. And one of the things that we've talked about frequently lately is the idea of the colossal disappointment in the church. Just like those who wanted a political Messiah were disappointed in Jesus, afraid of him and resentful of him and desired to kill him, so too are those who feel the same way about the church. That we had hoped that this would be, just like the disciples on the road to Emmaus, they're all downcast. So we had hoped that he would be the redemption of our people. But obviously he was a failure. He was not a failure, and there to find out he was not a failure. But that was the common disposition, and that was the common perception. So too is it with the church. We had hoped that the church would do thus and so. We had hoped that the church would prevent the world wars that we have experienced in the last 100 years. We had hoped that the church would not be riddled with corruption itself. We would hope that the church had catered to the whims and the desires of its people. We had hoped all of that, and in every case, the church has disappointed us. And so, in the background, we hear the voice of Caiaphas the high priest. Maybe it's best for one to die for the sake of the brethren. Maybe the church should be extinguished for the sake of the brethren. Then there will be no more disappointments with the Lord. Then there will be no more disappointments with the church. Well, we know from Jesus' promise that this is not going to happen. But we also know that in certain areas of the world, it has happened, and it certainly can happen again, and is in the process of happening, especially in formerly Christian places. So we take this, we overlay it, and what we see is the betrayal inside of the present age. What we see is the secular mindset, for instance, that we found in the story of the man born blind, even when the church does something spectacular for the sake of humanity or even of a human person. It's, well, it didn't do it the way I wanted it done. If you have redeemed a person, this comes to the fore really very clearly in the criticism of Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa's object was this, to allow the poor and abandoned to die having experienced at least once in their lives the love of another human person. That was attacked viciously by the atheist Christopher Hitchens, but also by a group of religious women out of Chicago. I don't know what the name of it was, saying, you know, of course, that she should take the political solution that the Pharisees took. She should be advocating the overthrow of the Indian government rather than taking care of the poor. There it is. It jumps right out at us, right out of the gospel. It's the same story. A new group of Pharisees, yes. A new group of infidelity, yes. A new blindness to who Jesus is and what his mission is, yes. But it's here also. And Jesus' parable of the Good Shepherd is his response. They may take it or leave it, but it's what he has to say. I lay down my life in order to take it up again, and I lay down my life for my sheep. On this, we can hope, and we can pray, and we can believe, and we can ask the Lord to protect us from the sin of the Pharisees.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
God, who